Hello and welcome to the inaugural IFLR Closing Conditions podcast. I'm John Kraft, Managing Editor of IFLR and Practice Insight. Over the last few years, my colleagues and I have had fascinating conversations with many of the most influential members of the financial and legal sectors, from lawyers, regulators, politicians, economists, traders, innovators, to CEOs. Until now, these interviews have been confined to IFLR.com and to our print magazine, but with this podcast, we've taken a big step into multimedia journalism. Every 2 weeks, either myself or one of the other IFLR journalists will have a one-on-one conversation with an industry leader to really hone in on a specific topic. We're going to be interviewing a wide selection of people, including winners of past individual awards and regular IFLR contributors, to make sure we keep things fresh and interesting in every episode. And today, we will kick things off with Nicholas Pfaff, who is Head of Sustainable Finance at the International Capital Markets Association and a member of the EU Platform on Sustainable Finance. And, more importantly, the winner of the 2021 IFLR Award for Outstanding Contribution to Regulatory Reform in Europe. So, a very warm welcome to Nicholas to the first IFLR Closing Conditions podcast. We thought you would be a perfect candidate for our very first episode. You've been in charge of sustainable finance at ICMA for a few years now, and with the organization for nearly a decade. During that time, you've been a regular source for numerous IFLR journalists, including myself, and I have little doubt that you'll have some excellent insights into the world of sustainable finance and beyond for listeners of the podcast today. So thank you very much for your time and congratulations once again. So I'm going to start you off today with a relatively easy question about the European sustainable finance scene more generally. So as a whole, it's very broad and it could almost run the risk of being confusing for those not really paying attention. You've got the EU taxonomy, the sustainable finance disclosure regulation, a number of working groups and task forces, of which you're a member of several, and of course, ICMA's own numerous guiding principles. They all play key roles. It's a very expensive but correlating field. Could you maybe please start by talking us through how these rules and initiatives work together to create the existing situation as you see it in Europe?
Thank you, John. I'll try. I think first it's important to distinguish what's been happening in the market over the last few years versus what has been developing in the regulatory sphere, mainly in Europe. So coming back to the market, what we've seen since 2014 is the increasing success of voluntary guidance for the sustainable bond market, as well as, you know, more broadly in the debt markets, including the loan markets. And this has been on the basis of very broad market support, market initiatives. What is best known is the Green Bond Principles, which were published indeed in 2014. But there are now a whole collection of guidance, social bond principles, sustainability-linked bond principles. We've also published a handbook for climate transition finance, etc. And this guidance has underpinned a increasingly dynamic and growing market, which has moved from or evolved from being really a niche market with less than 100 billion of issuance to a market now where we are getting close to annual issuance of about 700 billion, all sustainable bond categories inclusive, and where there is now an estimated sort of 1.6 trillion of stock out there. So still, by any measure, not one of the biggest markets, but it's become a very significant market. And one of the real benefits of this market beyond channeling sustainable finance, it is that we've seen a lot of progress on the conceptualization of how you invest in green and sustainable. You know, we've had a lot of debates, you know, academically or scientifically about what is green, what is sustainable. But I would argue the great achievement of the sustainable bond market has been, one, of course, you know, raising a lot of money, but two, making green and sustainable investable. Now, if you look in the regulatory space, and again, this is happening, or has happened historically primarily in Europe, but we see it spreading particularly to Asia. One, there's a focus on taxonomies, and the objective of taxonomies from the official sector is to narrow the and agree the definition of what is green and sustainable based on academic and scientific work. And this is, you know, generally welcome because, you know, the official sector can bring certainty, can bring resources, and this can become and has become an important reference point for the market. And then there has been many initiatives around disclosure, and you've mentioned a few, you know, SFDR, the taxonomy regulation itself in Europe, and now there's a new initiative around CSRD, that's for corporate disclosure, that's underway. And this is addressing transparency in the market through disclosures that are increasingly becoming mandatory. And this is particularly important, I would say, for the buy side in terms of, you know, understanding and having information with respect to what is actually, you know, meeting thresholds of sustainability, greenness, and more generally, you know, ESG factors.
I think before we kind of carry on into more specific questions, looking at some of these kind of rules and regulations you've just discussed, we should ask a kind of more holistic question of how highly you think the contribution of sustainable finance is. How would you rank it in the overall fight for a greener world and a more manageable climate?
I think that, you know, again, we should start with the increasing mobilization of capital at scale. You know, again, the amounts being raised in the sustainable market have gone from being confidential to, I would argue, you know, substantial. It's important, of course, to understand that all money for sustainable purposes doesn't have to come from the sustainable finance markets. It can come from the general markets. But that's the first achievement. You know, we've taken something which was a really small market and we've turned it into what I would say is now increasingly a mainstream market. And then the other thing that sustainable finance has done, particularly from the bond markets, is it has really progressed the awareness of sustainable issues, both in the corporate sector, but also very much in the policy sector. And it's really focused minds on what is actionable. I mean, you really, if you look at the debate a few years ago versus where it is today in both these worlds, you know, corporate and policy, it is much more focused and it is much more informed than it was before. Now, of course, there are other factors at play, you know, the increasing awareness of the public of the issues. But I would say that, you know, we've played an important role in that. And that is a soft but extremely powerful effect, I think, from the work that we've been doing.
One of the reasons that we gave you the award, and I think in previous conversations you've alluded to the fact that it was a big part of your kind of the last few years of your life, was your work on the sustainability-linked bond principles, which ICMA's kind of released fairly recently. Why don't you just talk me through what you see as the importance of those specifically in the current environment and why they've been so useful?
With this, you know, the work that we're doing on providing voluntary guidance, originally the Green Bond Principles, and now this most recently the Sustainability-Linked Bond Principles. And I'd like to underline that this work is one that is supported by ICMA, but is actually being driven by a really large, structured market initiative, which is referred to generically as the Green and Social Bond Principles. And this brings together, you know, over 400 organizations with a very structured governance, with an executive committee. And it is this initiative and its representatives that have, you know, been producing this work. And it's important to underline that because this is why it's taken so seriously and this is why it's consensual, because people understand that, you know, this is really the market getting together in a perhaps unprecedented manner to support, you know, such an important objective. Now, the sustainability-linked bond principles are important because they represent a Copernican moment, perhaps, for the sustainable bond markets, which historically had really focused on the use of proceeds approach. And the use of proceeds approach is one where, to some extent, you put aside what the issuer is doing generally, and you focus on what that issuer is doing specifically that is green and sustainable, and you aim to direct funds towards that, and you aim to get reporting on that. And it is historically been a narrow approach, but one that's been beneficial because it has short-circuited the bigger debate about, you know, I'm only going to finance you if you have this overall commitment, and I'm going to, you know, to some extent, I'm going to be stopped in financing you because of my preoccupation with what you're doing more generally. And that approach has been incredibly successful because it's allowed a whole universe of issuers who, you know, looking at their organizations may or may not be sustainable, but have been trying to move towards sustainability with a dedicated project type approach, right? And so it's sustainable assets, it's sustainable projects, which are either being financed or refinanced. Now, one of the criticisms of this approach is exactly where I started, which is to say, well, that's fine, but what about the overall organization? You know, is it okay to take a potentially brown issuer and say, well, I'm going to finance you as long as you are presenting, you know, a green project, regardless of whether that green project is really having an effect on your overall strategy? And so the sustainability-linked approach says, I'm going to finance you against key performance indicators and sustainability targets at the organization level, and I have a product which will penalize you, typically through an increase in the coupon, if you do not meet these targets. And this approach is particularly interesting when you start thinking about transition, because it allows you to go potentially to a brown issuer and say, I'm ready to finance you if you can show me credible targets, science-based metrics, which give me reassurance that you are in a credible manner going towards greater sustainability, you know, typically, for example, the reduction of greenhouse emissions. You know, where we are today is that this use of proceeds approach and the sustainability linked approach are actually coming closer, because what's happened in the market is it's increasingly difficult with a green bond, for example, to come to investors and say, only focus on what I'm doing here and don't worry about what's happening at the organization level. That's very difficult today because investors expect an overall commitment to sustainability. So increasingly, and you can see this in our guidance, what we've been saying with agreement principles is, sure, you know, let's focus on these proceeds, but by the way, you also have to tell us about your sustainability strategy, right? But so it's no longer true that the use of proceeds approach doesn't worry about what the organization is doing. But clearly with the sustainability linked product, we have something which really zeroes in on what you're doing at the organization level. And my final comment is you can combine both approaches. You know, you can be an issuer who has a program for green bonds and you focus on projects and assets. And you can then issue sustainability linked bonds if you've got a sustainability linked framework.
So let's talk about the EU taxonomy now, specifically with kind of copycat versions, which are kind of beginning to spring up. The Singapore, for one, has kind of announced that it's going to be doing a kind of similar taxonomy to the one we have in Europe. Do you expect the EU taxonomy to become interoperable with other versions going forward? And do you think it's important that they do that? And if there is divergence, what areas would you expect to see it?
That's a very interesting question. We've just put out an important publication on this topic where we do an overview of taxonomy initiatives globally, both those in the market and those being developed in the official sector, such as the EU taxonomy. But as you said, there's work underway in Singapore. Historically, there's been a de facto Chinese taxonomy, which is the referred to as the Green Bond Catalog. And, we see a number of jurisdictions which are developing taxonomies. Now, coming back to your statement, is it all going to be like the EU taxonomy? The answer is no. The EU taxonomy is a very sophisticated endeavor, which I don't think is going to be reproduced fully in other jurisdictions. And there's a lot that can be said about this. I'll try to keep it short. But the first thing is the EU taxonomy is, as you would expect, on the one level about thresholds of greenness or sustainability in relation to technical criteria, scientific, academic, and also a methodology to evaluate, you know, whether there's substantial contributions being done towards these criteria. But then there are two other legs to this, one which is related, and it's referred to as the do no significant harm approach. And this is the one where the taxonomy allows you to think at a sort of 360 degree level that, you know, if you are, for example, involved in, you know, climate mitigation, you need to be able to do a check, you know, for example, on what's happening in biodiversity when you're trying to apply this to the real world. And the idea is to ensure that that there isn't a sort of siloed approach to sustainability. Now, this is a very important concept in practice when you're bringing back to sustainable bond markets, and I would argue generally to the market, it's very tricky because asking, you know, any corporate actor to start talking about doing no significant harm, that immediately raises alarm bells in terms of, you know, potential liability, you know, because it's a very broad statement, as you can imagine. So, you know, try to talk about doing a significant harm in a U.S. context, you know, it's, in terms of litigation, et cetera, is something which is very challenging. But conceptually, it's very important. And then the other aspect of the EU taxonomy is the social minimum safeguards, which are very related to EU social legislation. So the reason I'm explaining all this is a lot of this is not exportable. You know, first, it is an approach which is very much for developed markets. It's not one which is easy to transpose in its complexity to emerging markets and also different jurisdictions. And the other thing, again, is, you know, while we can agree on the science and the technical aspects, it gets more difficult when you start, again, coming to do no significant harm or you come to the social minimum safeguards. So where I see global taxonomies, you know, aligning and hopefully having harmonization, it is around the technical aspects, scientific aspects, and it's very important, and we say this in our report, that jurisdictions don't all start reproducing the same work. So when we talk to, you know, for example, a jurisdiction in Asia, and they say, do you think it's a good idea to do a taxonomy? We say, you know, well, that's really your decision. But by the way, if you're going to do it, don't go out and try to, you know, reproduce everything that, for example, the EU's already done. Or for that matter, please look at what the Climate Bond Initiative has done in the market with its taxonomy. The work is done. So, you know, bring, right, you know, look at that and import it. You know, on the question of to what extent does another jurisdiction have to, again, start reproducing some of the, you know, the more sophisticated aspects of the EU taxonomy, this is where it's obviously up to the jurisdictions, but it's very complex. And then, you know, the other very important point is, you know, we need to be careful with taxonomies and in sustainable finance generally about having competitive objectives and too many objectives. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to prioritize. You know, when we started this work on taxonomies, and I was there at the beginning with the EU taxonomy, we started talking about climate mitigation adaptation, as you would expect. And since then, we've added a number of other, you know, environmental objectives, for example, biodiversity, circular economy, et cetera, all of which are extremely important. But there are some objectives where we're really on a clock, and there are others where we've got a bit more time. And so, you know, if you look at climate, we all know we're on a clock. We know that we're also on a clock increasingly on biodiversity, right? And so I think as we deploy these taxonomies, it's very important to maintain the sense of priority and the sense of urgency. And this is where I would argue we're getting into a little bit of trouble. Because when you start with these very complex taxonomies, the amount of work, the amount of discussion, the amount of potential disagreement mushrooms, and also the practical issues become, you know, extremely challenging when you bring them back to the real world of, okay, I'm trying to finance a project. What does the EU taxonomy say about it? How do I make this work, et cetera?
Would you put the UK in the same bracket as that then? So obviously since Brexit, there's kind of the regulatory divergence between the pair has become kind of a growing concern for much of the industry. And the UK has kind of suggested it might adopt the EU taxonomy, but it hasn't done. and there's also talks that it's going to kind of start its own version. How do you kind of see that playing out?
I think the UK is in a good position on this debate. The Chancellor came out almost a year ago with a comment which very much mirrors what I've just said, and that, you know, and it's been, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially we will base what we're doing on all the great technical work that's already been done, and then we'll figure out the rest.
Right.
And again, I think that's the right approach. If I was looking at what's happened with the EU, you know, there's always the problem of starting first, and there's a lot of benefit of coming a bit later. And I think the UK is in the benefit of being able to take a hard look at what's happened around the EU taxonomy, and to some extent take the bits which, you know, really work now and in practice, and to some extent sidestep one of the more difficult questions which I was alluding to earlier.
So another thing with the EU taxonomy is there's been some kind of voiced criticism that it was from the offset overly influenced by lobbyists and political forces. Is this a problem in your eyes, and is it something that can be overcome?
I think there is a very difficult discussion around some topics in sustainability which have come up in the discussion around the taxonomy. So for me, it's not about lobbying around the taxonomy. It's, there are some questions that arise from sustainability which are very difficult to translate into action, particularly at a policy and political level. So when you get to, you know, the points of disagreement that we're talking about with the taxonomy, you know, one of course is natural gas, and there are some genuine questions around, one, can we continue with natural gas as a fossil fuel, and, you know, over what time period, or is it something that really needs to be, you know, shut down in the very short run? And there are all kinds of, you know, all kinds of very good arguments on both sides in terms of saying, you know, it is really problematic versus saying, yes, but it's a lot better than some of the other alternatives. And, you know, one of the other big debates is nuclear, where on the one hand, you know, there isn't a problem with emissions, but there's a much bigger issue around doing a significant harm. And so I don't see, you know, a particular problem around lobbying around the taxonomy. What I see is a genuine political difficulty on making decisions which affect countries and economies in a fairly dramatic manner. There's some really hard choices that need to be made. The taxonomy is trying to help with those, but at the end of the day, it comes back to, you know, what countries at a political level are able to do individually or collectively. It's not the taxonomy that's the issue. It's the difficulty of making these decisions.
Another big difficulty, obviously, is greenwashing, which is a word that you hear more and more in the kind of day-to-day news and across the kind of financial news. Are you confident that the industry really has this under control? Or do you think, like other people suggested, it's an umbrella term that's being used in an accusatory way to kind of damage the whole sustainability debate?
You know, we need essentially to have a more informed and arguably a more intelligent debate around greenwashing. The first thing is to understand what we are putting under this umbrella term, and what are we talking about? And I would say we're talking about at least three things. One, it's about whether what is being financed is sufficiently green or sustainable. So it's a level of ambition. This is a real debate, but it's important to underline that this is a debate which is being addressed by the taxonomy efforts that we've been talking about. So there's a lot of work around this, and there's increasing consensus. So to say there's greenwashing going around on that area, I would argue that, one, I don't think so, and two, there's a lot of work being done on this. The second topic, which we put under greenwashing, I think is particularly around financial products, where we say, well, are the financial products, particularly investment products that are being marketed as green or ESG, do they really meet, you know, the right threshold, and are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? And this is, I would argue, an area of great complexity where there is also a lot of regulatory work being done, particularly in Europe. And why do I say it's complicated? Because it mixes this problem of my first problem, which is, you know, is there money actually going to uses that are genuinely green and sustainable? But it also covers the problem of definition between green, sustainable, and ESG, which are not the same thing. You know, ESG has concepts of governance and social issues, which green and sustainable don't necessarily have. So there's a confusion about what actually, you know, we're talking about. And then there is something which is not, I think, sufficiently recognized, is that there isn't enough to invest in. And then you've got technical constraints, which is if you have this massive money, you also, you know, you have to be able to ensure that it remains liquid. You have to make sure that you're not, you know, creating dysfunction in the market. So anyway, I could go on about this, but I would say when you talk about financial products, you've got a really complex issue. Now, what is being done about it? In Europe, tremendous amount of work, because particularly under the SFDR, you have categorizations now that are being proposed. You have disclosure recommendations that are being implemented. And I would say, you know, I don't necessarily think that the way it's being done is optimal in terms, because it can be complicated in terms of the regulations being proposed. But nonetheless, this is an area which is really being focused on, at least in Europe. And I think we are going towards a world where there's going to be a lot more clarity in the short run. Now, the final aspect of greenwashing, and I think this is the most problematic one, it's this idea that what I would refer to as a green laundering. You know, that what's happening is that issuers, or for that manner, you know, asset managers, are deliberately proposing products which are not green, you know, and so misrepresenting genuinely. I personally think that this is just not happening, and if it's happening, it's incidental. You know, I don't think that the people who are involved in sustainable finance, whether it's issuers or asset managers, are intentionally going out and misrepresenting to the market. And then you would say, well, what if I'm wrong? Well, if you're misrepresenting to the market, you know, this is like any misrepresentation, it's illegal. You know, there are securities laws out there which make you liable. So I would say, you know, if there are instances in the market of that degree of misrepresentation, we already have a legal framework out there to deal with it.
So my next question was about SFDR. So, I mean, that's quite a good segue. We've discussed it at length. How successful has it been so far? I know it's only been a few months, but have you kind of seen much impact with the rules?
In the medium term, I'm optimistic in the sense that I think it will provide a greater clarity around the products that are being proposed. So I think it is a significant and positive development. In the short run, it's very difficult because it is proposing definitions of different types of products based on criteria which are not yet sufficiently developed, which are very challenging to implement for the industry. And there is a lack of balance between what the buy side is being asked to do under SFDR. SFDR primarily addresses the buy side. So, you know, what your, you know, for example, what your asset manager is doing and what he has to report on versus what the issuers have to report. And so you have this real problem of data shortfalls of the information not being available, or confusion in terms of how you actually use the information. I think this is going to take a while to sort out, but again, I'm hopeful that at the end of the day, we will end up in a world where we are seeing much clearer definitions of terms of what is sustainable, what is not in the financial product area. But I would underline that we still have the supply problem, which I was mentioning earlier, and so we need to make progress also, you know, in the real world, in terms of what actually is available to meet the criteria that is being proposed to categorize these financial products.
Following on from that, what would you say are the kind of next steps for the industry more generally?
I think we have to have the best possible dialogue with regulators around disclosure. You know, we've mentioned SFDR, but I think generally this is a big topic, and that's where there's a lot of work that has to go on between the market and regulators. I think moving away from the question of disclosure, the big challenge out there is transition. And this also links to the question of maintaining priorities and having a better sense of where we're on a clock or not in sustainability. And I'm underlining this because one of the challenges, which we haven't talked about yet in the approach, the taxonomy-based approach, is that a lot of the effort is on categorizing what is green and sustainable today. There's not enough effort in terms of what is the path, what is the trajectory to sustainability, or how taxonomies can be used to target outcomes. What we've been trying to do with the sustainability-linked bonds concept, again, is to make it dynamic. So you've got a brown company, it makes commitments to you, they have to be science-based, they have to be ambitious, you invest in it, they don't meet the targets, there's a punitive mechanism. So we've provided, through the Climate Transition Finance Handbook, guidance on disclosures and transition strategies, which are trying to help all of this sustainable finance that is being raised, whether it's through, you know, green bonds or whether through sustainability linked bonds, to occur in a manner where the issuer is providing with the greatest clarity possible information on how they are implementing transition. And, you know, and what I'm talking about, of course, is climate transition. And again, this is really, I think, the greatest challenge for sustainable finance with respect to net zero 2050, where we need to get to ensure that, you know, we are in a world where we're somewhere near, you know, the 1.5 degree or the 2 degree target, and we are not putting ourselves in a situation where, you know, we will have catastrophic outcomes in terms of, you know, climate, but also with all the consequences in terms of political effects, you know, natural disasters, conflicts, etc.
Okay, which moves us neatly on to talking about the United States. When you bring up politics, it was no secret that former President Trump was no advocate of sustainability. But since his inauguration, President Biden's been very keen to help promote the concept of green finance and the kind of green transition overall, and his plan for climate change and environmental justice has taken on a much more prominent role in U.S. policy. So how important do you think that this kind of overall shift is in general for the kind of move towards sustainability and in the quest to achieve some form of kind of taxonomical harmony?
I think it's tremendously significant. I would say that it's important to understand that under the previous administration and historically, U.S. market participants have been extremely active in sustainable finance. So we are not in a situation where somehow, you know, U.S. Organizations stopped being involved in sustainable finance for several years. They didn't. They've continued. They've been involved in all our working groups. They're very implicated in the market initiative that I referred to. Now, at a higher level, you know, having the U.S. rejoin the Paris Agreement is fundamentally important. You know, I cannot overemphasize, you know, the significance of that. And then if you look at specifically what's happening in sustainable finance in the U.S., on the one hand, you can see regulators starting to shift very, very quickly and adopt some of the concerns and potential policy options that we've seen in other jurisdictions, you know, in the Europe, but also more in Europe, also more widely. But what you can also observe is that there is differences in approach and perhaps the U.S. is still at a, you know, at an earlier stage of the path that we're on sustainability, because what I'm seeing now is not a debate around taxonomies. What we're seeing is a debate around disclosure, particularly around the TCFD, which is, you know, is a very important starting point. We are also seeing that although it is easier to talk in the wider corporate world in the U.S. about climate transition, it's not, you know, we don't have in any way the degree of consensus that we have in other jurisdictions. You can still see some major corporates struggling with this whole concept that they, you know, they have to commit, you know, in a substantial manner to sustainability and transition. But you can also see, aspects in the US which are perhaps more active than other jurisdictions. I'm thinking particularly in, shareholder action. We've seen some really interesting things happen with respect to major fossil fuel producers, finding themselves confronted with decisions from their shareholders that they would never have anticipated a few years ago. So, the U.S., what's happening there is extremely important. We live in more optimistic times than we did a few months ago, perhaps.
We sure do. So what about China then, as the world's second largest economy and the most populous country? Its sustainability contribution is undeniably crucial. Do you think the country is doing enough, or that enough is being done to ensure the country is doing what it can to help drive towards a sustainable future?
I think if you focus on what China has been doing in sustainability, they have matched to a large degree the degree of urgency and the policy activism that we've seen in Europe. Arguably, they've even moved quicker in terms of regulating sustainable finance markets. And also, they've made progress in terms of converging with other jurisdictions, and particularly on topics such as clean coal, which was a big bone of contention. And I think it's important to understand that from China's perspective, if you dial back sort of 5 years, the primary objective was pollution. And a lot of what they did at the time should be understood from that perspective. And it's only in the last 2 years that the shift is really towards climate transition. And I think that there is a alignment of the planets, if I can put it that way, between where China has been going, where Europe is going, and where increasingly the US is going. So, I think that China with the EU is clearly a bright spot in terms of what's been happening in sustainable finance globally.
So, it's clear from your answers and from having covered this for several years that sustainable finance as a whole has come a very long way in a very short time, but has a very long way yet to go. So what else are you kind of hoping to achieve with ICMA to help drive the industry forwards towards a better future?
I think there are perhaps two things. One, we have to all collectively make transition finance work. And as I was saying earlier, we need to spend arguably less effort about determining what is the darkest shade of green, and spend more time in terms of thinking about how we move the hard to abate sectors towards greater sustainability in a manner which is, empowers them to do so. And rather than necessarily in an accusatory manner. I'm not saying that blame should not be ascribed at all, but what I am saying is, it's very important to try to empower and incentivize as much as possible the broadest segment of the economy that needs to change towards transition. The second thing that we need to do successfully is this whole regulatory developments in sustainable finance. It's very important that we keep the balance between what the market's doing, what regulators are doing. And it's very important that we don't get in a situation where, with the best intentions in the world, regulatory developments actually start constricting in a unnecessary manner what's happening in sustainable finance. And also, we don't, because we are trying to ensure transparency, we don't start creating a kind of sustainable finance bureaucracy, which is more focused on getting all the metrics and all the definitions right, as opposed to actually ensuring that substantially the economy as a whole is moving towards sustainability, again, with this hard stop that we all have collectively around 2050, where we really need to get to net zero.
We sure do. Great. Well, thank you so much, Nicholas, for all the work you've been doing in this field, and obviously for your time today. It's been fascinating, and I hope all of our following podcasts are as interesting as this one's been.
Thank you very much, John. It's been a pleasure.
Speak to you soon. Thank you.